From Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., this is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics with your host and moderator, Justin Russell.
Hey, out there in Radio Land, it is time for the best podcast that you've never downloaded. It is Backroom Politics. Joining me in studio, as he does every recording, he is the former Undersecretary for International Development. He is the one we know as Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin.
And joining us remote from an undisclosed location in the Bay State of Massachusetts, he is the author of such great books as American Politics on the Rocks. He is the one that we know as Rich Rubino. Hey, Rich.
Hi, Justin.
And, of course, we've got kind of a skeleton crew. We've got Rob the Engineer behind the glass. I can't see him. Rob, they got this big screen TV. I can't see your pretty face.
I think you're better off for it.
That could be true. I do have a face for radio, so I get that. Hey, in case you haven't been noticing, a lot of your afternoon TV is being taken up not by Days of Our Lives, because that has been canceled, shockingly, but by another soap opera going on here in Washington, D.C. That would be the impeachment inquiry that's happening. It has been interesting what we saw. Oh, wait a minute. Popping up on the big screen here in the smoke-encrusted central office of Backroom Politics here at Studio A in Podcast Village, he is the longtime Biden political operative and Democratic lawyer from D.C. and Maryland. He is one we know as Dan Lipner, Esquire. Hello, Daniel.
Hey, sorry I was late. I was trying to find Jim Jordan's sport jacket, and man, it's just hiding. You just can't find it.
Okay. You're giving Jim Jordan fashion tips. That's brilliant. Speaking of Jim Jordan, we've been seeing a lot going on in the impeachment inquiry. When we record this podcast, we're doing this on a Tuesday. This morning, we saw Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who is a Ukrainian expert, detailed from the U.S. Army over to the National Security Council, and Jennifer Williams, who was the Vice President's National Security Advisor on Ukraine and Eurasia. Interesting takes. Now, this follows an explosive week of the testimony that we saw. The big one being the big, explosive, dramatic hearing was that of former Ukrainian ambassador and longtime foreign service officer, Ambassador Yovanovitch. But let's start from the beginning. We started this last Tuesday when we started talking about it. We haven't really gotten into detail. Are the Democrats hitting the mark on these hearings? Because I got to tell you, depending on which day, it could go either way.
70% of the American public says what the president did was wrong, and everything that's out there seems to be adding to that belief. 51% of the American public says not only should he be impeached, he should be removed from office. So unless you're seeing some numbers that are moving the other direction, I'm going to go out on a limb and say Pelosi and Schiff are doing a good job as far as how they're laying this out for everyone else. And they're getting support from folks, including comedians. Seth Meyers, one of the funnier ones, pointing out all the information in a very simple, bite-sized way of saying, okay, so you want all this information? Here it is. And it's succinct and accurate. If the numbers are moving the other way, I'd love to see it.
But Alan Moore, you know, I've also seen the same numbers that say that over 60% of Americans have already made up their mind on the issue of impeachment. The number hasn't really changed since the beginning of the hearings regarding those who favor impeachment and removal. That kind of hangs right around the 49 to 51 mark, depending on which polls you look at. Is this just now a large kabuki dance, or are we in fact seeing evidence that might sway particularly Republicans in voting for possible impeachment and removal?
So I don't see it as a dance. It's a serious enterprise. The persons who have testified so far were mostly talking about things that they witnessed that regarded persons other than the president. Remember, this is impeachment. The president is the ultimate target. And one of the criticisms that the that the ever flexible Republican critics have had is no one here has even met the president. This is all hearsay, all hearsay, all hearsay. And the Democrats legitimately say, we would love to talk to persons who were in the room when it happened, to borrow from the musical Hamilton. But the president won't give them to us. He won't give us John Bolton. He won't give us Mick Mulvaney. He won't give us Rudy Giuliani. He won't give us Mike Pompeo, for that matter, who we haven't heard a lot about, but who was also in the midst of this stuff. And Rick Perry. We're going to hear from the EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland tomorrow, who has some explaining to do, if you will, because he was present for many of the meetings and discussions. So the problem for the Democrats is to be able to sustain public interest. Those of us in D.C. who have
But this the time, seems like an inside the beltway kind of televised event.
Well,
I mean, we're not seeing
it. That's the challenge. Watch Saturday Night Live on a regular basis to sort of get a sense from even what some of the smart people in New York are thinking. And their take last Saturday night was, OK, Days of Our Lives is gone, but Days of Impeachment is the new daily soap opera. And it's a little confusing. And some of the characters are sort of caricatures of themselves. But is it compelling? And is it clearly laid out that a crime warranting removal from office was committed, and that is a huge lift.
Rich Rubino, Alan brings up the fact that, you know, you look at Saturday Night Live, you look at the late night comics, and they're taking swipes at this. It's evident that, well, actually, let me reverse this. Does it strike you that the only people who care about this seem to be those inside the Beltway and your occasional political wonks west of the Mississippi? How are they, being the Democrats, going to convince the rest of America that they should watch this, they need to watch it, and there's important information coming out?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people certainly following it, or at least have peripheral information about what's going on. I mean, it's always going to be, you know, 40% of the public that's just kind of blasé about the whole thing. I think that is, no matter what's going on in politics, barring, you know, something like Vietnam, where potentially they could get drafted and they have a specific self-interest. But I don't think those are necessarily the people that they want to go after. I think what they want to go after is the people who are actually involved, at least somewhat. Even if on the surface, in the partisan political process, but it's also a way. I mean, just from a political perspective, you have to realize that the chances that he's going to be impeached are probably pretty good. The chances that when he goes to the United States Senate, that 2/3 with a Republican-controlled Senate will actually convict him are probably pretty slim to none right now, unless there's some cataclysm that comes out that we don't know about in the next couple of months. So it's really just about ginning up the base more than anything else. It's about galvanizing the Democrats together so that in the 2020 presidential election, as many people on the Democratic base, and as for that matter, as many kind of swing voters decide to support Trump. I mean, who heads potentially the Obama, the 6.7 million Americans, for example, who supported Barack Obama, then supported Donald Trump in the last election. Those are the people that they're really going after. On the Republican side, it's just a way for them to say that this is what Trump would call a witch hunt, and for the Republicans to kind of stay on their side of the reservation and to galvanize as many conservatives to come out of the ballot box as possible. But it's really a political it's really political theater right now, and there's really I can't really see an actual substance of an actual impeachment coming out right now. But as I said earlier, a cataclysm could happen. If a cataclysm happens and Trump's job approval goes below 30%, then just like Nixon and Watergate, it's incumbent on Republicans up for re-election, you know, in the Senate, like Cory Gardner from Colorado, might actually have to drop the anvil and vote for it.
Dan Lipner?
So Rich is actually right, and this is a reoccurring theme of how people get our framework wrong. So it's sort of regardless of what the outcome is of what those in elected office do, it's how the voters respond to what they do. So in this case, the House has the numbers for majority or to recommend impeachment to the Senate for trial. And then the Senate requires a supermajority, requiring every senator to go on record saying, essentially, I do not believe he should be removed or he should be removed. That is the choice of each individual senator. So that's Cory Gardner, that's Susan Collins, and that could be a few others that we haven't even paid attention to. And questions of integrity and how the American public chooses to see things. This same issue goes all the way back to the 2000 election, where if you take the political question out of the hands of the voters, that's a problem. So in this case, going forward and laying out the case in a very public way, as the House is doing, in a methodical way, and allowing people to make that decision, and then when the trial occurs in the Senate, presumably the trial is going to occur in the Senate, and senators can choose to say, listen, Trump wasn't wrong at all. This is great. This is how we should do things. They can say this is wrong, but it's not removable. Or they can say this is wrong, and the man's got to go Pence 2019.
But
there is a political question, and the voters get to then go to the ballot box the next time around and say, I think my senator was right or my senator was wrong what the president did.
Alan Moore, is Dan being realistic or is he living in this fantasy world?
Well, no, he's just, as I hear him, he's just describing things as they are. There's an irony in this process, and that is that at the moment, the Democrats seem to be getting something positive for Democrats out of it. At the moment, I would say that the Republicans have taken some hits, but even when you look at these numbers of people who support removal, for example, which is around 50%, which is a scary number. Forget the vote.
Why is that number so scary to you?
Because you got half the country saying, to heck with the electorate and the election of 2016 or the one coming up. We need to intervene and remove. So you've had probably 40% of the Democrats that would have impeached virtually from day one for his behavior while he was a candidate, for his behavior in the aftermath, for the way the election itself played out. So you've had removed Trump from the very beginning, and probably in the neighborhood of the high 30s, and then it's been creeping up. The fact that it's continuing to creep up in the face of the Ukrainian crisis, if you will, is instructive and it's interesting. Now, having said that, 70%, and it's also instructive that 70%, as Dan mentioned, think that what the president did was wrong. But that's a far cry from saying, because people know that presidents do things wrong in a whole host of ways. That's a high number. That is a high number, but it doesn't translate.
But it also shows that 20% of that number believes that, yeah, he did stuff wrong, but who cares?
Not who cares, but should he be removed? There's a big difference between who cares. People care. They're willing to say that. They don't particularly like it, but that doesn't mean they're saying toss him out. There's an irony here in this whole thing that I've been struck by. When Mick Mulvaney, and I'm not a huge fan of Mick Mulvaney, especially in his role as let president do what he wants, as the acting chief of staff, which is just a very bizarre business. When he got out and said in front of the cameras, we were talking about trade-offs. Grow up, get over it. That's what we do all the time. Mulvaney was right. And if the president and the White House and their lawyers had said, you know, I think Mick is on to something here. Let's acknowledge that we horse trade all the time. And that's what this was. Call it a quid pro quo. Call it whatever you want. It's what we do. They tried to deny it. No.
Right.
No quid pro quo. That's not what happened. Oops. Mulvaney has to pull back. And then, of course, as all these witnesses come forward, it's transparently obvious that there was trading going on. Now, the question is, if you're doing that kind of trading, is it legitimate, legal, not impeachable?
Well, the legality is the one that's in question.
Well,
the legality, I mean, these are, Dan, check my math on this as the attorney in the House right now. These are congressionally appropriated funds that were set for implementation for set U.S. foreign policy as dictated not by the Obama administration. This was Trump administration policy that they were implementing in the issuance of that money.
That is correct. And they and the
correct.
Executive so, branch has the ability.
Hold on, Dan. Hold on.
We need to clarify.
Hold on, Dan. Let Alan finish, and then I'll go to you. Hold on.
The executive branch has the responsibility to carry out the law. And one of the things they do and did was to say, how are they doing on corruption? There was a review led by the State Department, but with participation from the intelligence services.
And DOD.
And DOD. How are they doing? Are we confident that they're going to spend this money
that's
right?
That's where.
And that was done and completed. And then the president apparently, reportedly, this is going to what we're trying to determine here, stepped in and said, hang on here, guys. Well, it becomes a problem.
Because they had already been certified. The requirements were that part of the issuance of the money was deemed that the government in Kiev was putting out or was dealing with issues related to corruption inside the Ukrainian government. When DOD signed off on this, it then became moot. They said, look, had they met the requirements of the anti-corruption criteria in the bill, DOD signed off on it, the IC signed off, and State Department signed off, and it was all done, said and done, wrapped up when the president went, yeah, I want this favor first.
Well,
that's according to testimony we've heard over the past couple of days.
And then the question is, so how much authority does the executive branch have in a circumstance like this? And it's clear that the executive has some authority. Now, it also has some explaining to do
if it chooses to further delay. Let's go to Dan. Dan Lipner, you had thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, Alan's correct. There is some discretion. And this is the fact that the Trump administration are a bunch of morons. And I don't say that lightly.
I'm so glad
we're
being
civil. I mean,
they're
a bunch of morons. If they had actually... So let me explain how you would do this properly. If you
violate the law?
If you actually believe that there is an issue with Joe Biden, that he is going to be the Democratic nominee, and you actually believe there is even a hint of a there with Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, the way you do this properly is you don't go in with a laser target saying, well, Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's corrupt processes show that this is how they are actually behaving illegally. No. What you do is you have a robust anti-corruption system within the foreign aid mechanism in the White House. And incidentally, look, it's discovered that there's an issue here and we need to make sure Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's issues are actually not an issue with corruption in Ukraine. That is not even close to what has occurred in Ukraine. They have gone in with a laser scalpel, narrowly picking at the Joe Biden thing, and at each and every phase, when anyone has been asked, they have direct knowledge as to whether or not there is a there with either the issues with Ukraine and the 2016 right. election, or Joe Biden and the gas company whose name is now escaping
Burisma.
Me.
Burisma.
Burisma. Burisma. Every person who has testified has said no. The intelligence agencies have said no. There is no there there, including today. They said there is no there there.
All right, but Rich Rubino, you know, we've heard Alan say that there's horse trading been going on forever. Dan is saying, you know, what Dan's saying is, look, the horse trading's been there. That's not the real cause of the concern. Where do we land in this? Where have we seen this in history? Is there horse trading done all the time? Are we seeing something new out of the Trump administration?
Well, I think there's horse trading, but I think that horse trading, I think that where the line is drawn is where the horse trading involves domestic politics. I think certainly there's horse trading. You say essentially, you know, we'll give you this. And, you know, go back to the days of Lyndon Johnson in the Senate, you know, when he was Senate Majority Leader, he would give certain senators, you know, certain he would give them certain offices. He would give them certain largesse if they vote for legislation, you know, go back to the Civil Rights Act in 57. That's all legitimate. When it's illegitimate is when someone comes and directly says to a foreign leader, says, you know, if you investigate somebody who I'm, I guess, afraid of as a domestic political opponent, Joe Biden, in return, I'll give you these appropriations that Congress has already agreed to. And I think that's something that's really, at least as far as we know, that's something that's unprecedented. And I think that's where kind of the line is drawn. But, I mean, obviously horse trading, just like lobbying, is always going to be a part of American politics, a part of politics in any sort of a constitution or republic.
Let's talk a little bit about the witnesses themselves and how these hearings have gone down. Let me start with you, Alan Moore, Chairman Adam Schiff. One of the things that I saw coming out of the box, which kind of didn't give me a good feeling, was on day one, last Wednesday, when we saw Adam Schiff open up the hearings and his opening statements. I thought it was a great opportunity for him to just, you know, all he had to do was say, Vladimir Putin's bad, Russia bad, we support our Ukrainians, give them money, what the president did was wrong, and then start questioning, or at least hand it over to counsel. It almost seems like they're intentionally trying to overcomplicate this, at least from the Democrats' view. There's no simplicity in any of the arguments that I'm hearing coming out of particularly Adam Schiff's team.
Well, it's a complicated set of issues. And it's a complicated timeline with a dozen or more different players, each of whom has a slightly different role and each of whom has participated in a slightly different way. And so there's a challenge. How do you keep the public's attention to something that occurred over a year and has a whole, you know, a bunch of players? Some of whom, the ones we've seen, are quite articulate and kept notes and are prepared to share. And then, of course, some of whom are implicated along the way who we cannot hear from for various reasons. And we want to hear from, not least of all, the president himself, who's now dangling the possibility, well, maybe I could answer some questions.
Let me ask
writing.
You this question. If you are the White House counsel, do you recommend that the president testify in front of the Intelligence Committee on this issue?
Well, not testify. No. But possibly
written vacation? Yes.
Written interrogatories. Another option that a president has is he can simply give a speech. I mean, he can go out and say at some point, hey, there's a lot of confusion about what I was doing, what I did, what I didn't do. And I want to just let you, the American people, hear from me. Here's how I saw it. Here's why I said there was no quid pro quo. Here's how I was interpreting those words in that meaning.
Is this president capable? You're talking about a Ronald Reagan from the Oval Office mea culpa for Iran-Contra. You're talking about a George W. Bush, you know, explanation of Iraq and humility. Is this president capable of that?
Well, so I'm not saying he is. I was simply talking about options of how to get his personal story out there other than through tweets that come out with the wrong content at the wrong time and that further complicate and set back his team's effort.
Right.
So all I'm saying is I think at some point we need to hear from him. When he said in tweeting, no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo, and everything over here from a whole host of witnesses makes it look like, yeah, there was a quid pro quo. And how does he reconcile that? We would benefit. The country would benefit from hearing something either in a speech, but more likely in an interrogatory in writing, as he did with Mueller.
Rich Rubino, the question I have for you is, even looking at historically, we're not seeing the explosive testimony that we would have seen, you know, where, or we're not seeing the exact smoking gun or the 14 seconds of blank tape here. Are we just drawing out testimony for the sake of leading into an election year? Or is there possibly something that we're going to see or hear that is going to massively change the scope of American view on this?
Well, you never rule out the possibility there's something that, you know, Adam Schiff is going to pull out, you know, some sort of a rabbit out of his hat in the last minute. But my guess is that's not going to happen. No, I think this is all about electoral politics, or at least almost all about electoral politics, because once Donald Trump is impeached, it's going to, just like the Clinton impeachment, everybody knew that Bill Clinton was not going to be convicted in the United States Senate. Even though it was controlled by Republicans, you needed 2/3 of the United States Senate to vote for an impeachment, to vote for a conviction, and everyone knew that was not going to happen. So he gets impeached in the House, then it goes to the United States Senate, and the United States Senate overwhelmingly rules that he's not guilty, and then it's over. In that case, it backfired on the Republicans because their plan was essentially to bring his job approval ratings as low as possible, which could potentially be deleterious for Al Gore trying running to succeed him in 2000. None of that worked. He left office with a 66% job approval rating, higher than any other president in the history of polling. In the case of Donald Trump, it's the same thing. They want an enfeebled President Donald Trump as much as possible, both on the policy front in terms of trying to get his legislative agenda through Congress, but also on the electoral front. And they also, at the same time, they want to put Republicans on record as supporting Donald Trump. They want to put Susan Collins in Maine, Cory Gardner in Colorado, Republicans in swing states, perhaps even Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, who on the record that they support Donald Trump. And then theoretically, if it's job approvals at, you know, 30-31%, then he's this big incubus around them, and then they're running for reelection, and they have to defend themselves, and they want to put the Democrats in the catbird seat. But it's all about electoral politics, and I think there might be some people in the actual, there are certainly members of the population who think that he's actually going to be convicted, but a lot of those are also the same people who think that impeachment is tantamount to conviction. So there's a lot of, I think, ignorance in the body politic as
well. Dan Lipner?
I think that's actually a little too cynical. While there, I actually genuinely mean that. So
yes,
there is an element of politics. There is politics in everything in Washington. That's how that works. However, there is actually an element of right and wrong. And the occasional Republican that spoke up before they got smacked down very publicly. And if you have any questions about this, the poor Colorado radio show host who got taken down mid-show for not towing the party line with Donald Trump. There is actually a question of right and wrong. And even if you lose, there is a conscientious, respectful loss. And if you have to fight for the righteous, and even if you lose, you're on the record for being on the side of the angels. And when you say the president's domestic agenda, I simply ask, what's the agenda? I mean, it's been a joke in Washington for more than 3 years. You know, it's transportation or infrastructure week in the White House.
Right.
Where's the infrastructure plan? I mean, there's a real question about this. The only thing the president has rallied around and spoken up about is about, by the way, hey, another round of tax cuts. Because, you know, the deficit isn't quite high enough because, you know, the pump priming there. Come on. Like, there is a real question here. And Trump, I mean, there's been so many issues in so many places. Even the wall, there was a internal report saying not a foot of additional wall has been built during the Trump administration. And this is even with him refusing the deal that Democrats agreed to. I mean, what is he there there?
Okay, but so, Alan Moore, real
quick. I guess
quick.
Prescription drugs would be one thing. That's one thing he continues to talk about from something that's very popular. He talks about how he's going to bring
he
down.
He talks about it. Where's the policy?
Right.
Well, I mean, he would just say it as part of his legislative agenda, and certainly as a convention speech in 2020, he's going to say, we have this great plan, but he's going to say that Nancy Pelosi is trying to stifle it. That's why we need. And he also talks, interestingly, he talks a lot about an environmental plan. He actually, in a sense, some sense, endorsed Jill Stein when the issue was brought up of whether Tulsi Gabbard was some sort of a Russian asset. He said something to the effect of, well, you know, I think that many people on the left, that's why they supported Jill Stein last time, because the Democrats have no environmental agenda.
And we'll talk about 20. And we'll talk. And we'll talk about 2020 Democrat stuff here later on this week. But I do want to ask Dan Lipner. Dan, when we talk about the Republicans on this, are the Republicans really doing themselves any favors? Is Jim Jordan being effective, or is Ranking Member Nunes being effective in getting what semblance of a Republican defense for all of this? I guess that's the bigger question is, one, is there a visible defense to all this that the Republicans are getting out there? And two, are they doing a good job of promoting that defense?
So I didn't write down notes as far as the nonsense arguments, but Nunes has repeatedly said, you know, this is a show, this is fake. When former Ambassador Yakovich, forgive me if I mispronounce her name.
Yovanovitch.
Nunes in his opening statement asks why this isn't just an internal HR matter for the State Department. Okay. This woman actually got a standing ovation at the end of her testimony. That's interesting. She held herself remarkably well. And to some extent, at least, and I know none of us on the show are normal, so let me say that on the outset.
But speak for yourself, Dan.
All of the people who are career civil servants who have appeared before this committee are American heroes. Every last one of them, including today, the woman whose name is escaping me, who is the Pence advisor.
Jennifer Williams.
Who are all wanting to do the right thing on behalf of the American, not just the American people, but the country as a whole. All of these folks are handling themselves with perfect dignity and showing themselves to be patriots. And while I'm not normal, I honestly wonder what the focus groups are seeing when they see these folks testifying. And I gotta say, they seem legitimate. They seem like they're trying to do their jobs the best they can in the interest of the United States.
Well, let's
and the Republicans and Jim Jordan and Representative Nunes, and I don't want to single out too many other folks, though the female representative from New York, whose name again,
Elise Stefanik,
who has a pretty impressive resume for the song and dance she did the last go round when Nunes tried to hand off his questioning to her, which was a clear violation of the House rules, which she had to know, which was absolutely kabuki theater. Go, oh my God, see, the Democrats are not letting us ask questions.
But Rich Rubino goes deeper than that. I mean, we've seen,
and even Walt from Fox News said so.
All right, but we've seen Rich Rubino, everything from as late as today, when we record the hearing with Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you've got Republicans literally doing smear an open hearing, an open testimony on a not only a combat badge wearing, but Purple Heart recipient, Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army, whose family fled Russia. Tell me where it makes sense.
And by the
to,
way, the Army is protecting him. He's getting special protection.
Yeah, we're getting word of that too.
Of threats against him.
And okay. Why do
and
we know that?
A military base too.
Right, but again, let me go back to my original question: is what are the Republicans going to do themselves any favors by taking smear shots at a Purple Heart recipient? At a career foreign service officer who has had an exemplary record in some of the biggest, toughest embassies in the world, or others that have testified so far. What's the game?
No, I don't see any benefit to the individual Republicans. You know, former Senator Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, a Republican, said that he thinks that there would be about 25 to 35 Republicans that if it was a secret ballot would essentially vote to convict the president. Senator, basically talking about the senators, I think that for the most part, I think the preponderance of members of the House who are certainly not only the ones necessarily on the Intelligence Committee, but I think just most members in general who are Republicans, I mean, you know, they're not necessarily loyal to Donald Trump, but they're loyal to the fact that, and it does come back to being cynical, I guess, the fact that a lot of these come from very gerrymandered districts that if they do anything to sidestep, if they do anything to criticize or to be seen on the wrong side of Donald Trump, they risk a primary opponent and they risk the possibility of the general election of some members of their base potentially voting for a third party or staying home. Donald Trump is not necessarily one of them. You know, he didn't grow up a Republican. He wasn't part of the Young Republicans. He's somebody who converted to the conservative cause out of political convenience. You listen to him in 2000, he was considering running for the Reform Party nomination. He talked about how pro-choice he was. He talked about how the Republican Party was too tough on immigration. They know essentially, I think most Republicans know that he's playing a game here, but they're in the game. They're in this kind of weird positioning because they also know that if, you know, a guy who's got 85%, 90% support within the Republican Party, they essentially have to defend him, even though he's perhaps not one of them. He's not the person that they necessarily want to support. I think they would rather, frankly, be working on legislation, doing constituent service, than focusing all this time on somebody that they don't particularly like, who they're basically scared of, and they're afraid that what's going to happen to them is what happened to Mark Sanford in South Carolina last time. You know, Mark Sanford tried to question the president a little bit. So President Trump supports a Republican opponent. His Republican opponent beats him in the primary and then goes on to lose the general election to Representative Cunningham. But that's basically what the fear is in the Republican Party. It's not that they have some sort of a loyalty to him. I bet my guess
if
would be that
there were a real Democratic presidential primary for that to be laid out at a national level.
Yeah. But Alan Moore, let me bring up one of the key factors that have come out of these series of hearings. I'm going to start with you and the Trump tweet during Ambassador Yovanovitch's hearing, where he basically just came out and just, you know, tried to smear campaigner while she was actively testifying under oath in a hearing room on the Hill. Is there any legitimacy to them saying that is witness tampering?
Well, so I think that it has much more impact on future witnesses rather than her. There was no guarantee she would even know what was being tweeted. She was testifying. It was brought to Chairman Schiff's attention that this was tweeted, and he jumped all over it. I don't blame him for it. He's never been my favorite. I don't like either him or Nunes, but I don't have any quarrel with him having that, saying, oh, my God, we got gold here.
Is it witness tampering?
I don't know that it's witness tampering, because she was all if it was witness tampering, then the question is, was it the president or Schiff who brought it to his attention, her attention? She would not have even known. But it's stupid is what it is, and it's disgusting. So and I do think it has a potential chilling effect on others more so than her. It helped make her a hero. Here's the problem for this president. They have no plan. They have no strategic group, and he has no discipline. So he gets a gut feeling about something and thinks that being a genius that he believes himself to be, he tweets something out to trash her and her whole history, and the world is legitimately horrified and appalled. I was disgusted. I thought, what a nasty, hateful bully this president is.
As opposed to the past 3 years?
Well, no. There's one thing to just, you know, go out there and say nasty, ugly shit. In a variety of forms and different ways.
Beep.
So
that's the word that Donald Trump used for Adam Schiff too.
But this in this particular case, here's this woman who is describing the personal hell that she went through in the course of all of this, and anybody paying attention realizes, oh my gosh. This took a personal toll. This isn't just some robotic government employee. This was a pretty horrible narrative.
Right.
And she talks about how horrifying it was to know what our president said to the Ukrainian president. And then in real time, he comes out and says, every place she's ever served has gone bad. It made me really, really angry in a different kind of. I mean, I'm critical of him all the time, and he picks on groups of vulnerable
this
people.
This was a personal
this
attack.
This was an individual
this is a personal
that
attack.
He, the president, chose right. to single out. And I and you know, does that mean that he should be impeached? That it constituted witness tampering? Interesting discussion, interesting arguments. But
let's go to the lawyer.
Well, you know, Dan doesn't have the answer. He can talk about what the grounds might be, but you know,
but again,
it may be grounds for impeachment, but you know, another article of impeachment. But everybody understands that this is the kind
right.
of thing he does. But he steps on his own
toes.
Private parts
right.
when he does this, and he
right.
neutered the Republicans in their questioning of Ambassador Yovanovitch
right.
because suddenly she's a sympathetic figure. Thanks to his grotesque ugliness.
Got it. Go ahead, Dan Lipner.
Well, so I have been making a point to talking to normal people throughout this process. And amongst that process, when Trump said, you know, she's been out for herself, or some of the Trump talking point supporters have said she's out for herself, and just trying to grandstand, I said, you know, Somalia has great beaches and, you know, it's got a lot of sunshine. That's obviously the only reason she took that post in the State Department. And, you know, that pesky little failed state stuff, you know, and it being dangerous and, you know, at risk to her personally and physically, that's nonsense. Okay, so that's obviously tongue in cheek. And witness tampering isn't.
Where are you going with this? Where are you going with this?
So
where are you going with this?
Taking a turn there. Witness tampering isn't just about the witness that's testifying. It's about other witnesses as well. So when you go after a witness who's going out there publicly and you kneecap them, I believe somebody actually used that phrase during the hearings thus far. Actually, it may have been Ambassador Yovanovitch.
Yovanovitch.
Yes, it's not about that witness. It's about every other witness. Every other witness who says, dear God, I don't want this headache. I don't want this pain. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
It's Vindman, people. Getting... Vindman.
Vindman.
Vindman. Two children.
Okay. You'll get that. Go.
A lieutenant colonel from the Army who testified. There's only been one.
Go.
That'll
go.
It. Who's getting special protection from the Army. He's active duty. And all of this stuff absolutely has an effect on those folks. For other folks who might be holding the smoking gun or thinking, dear God, I have a wife. I have a husband. I have kids. I have family. Do I want them to go through all of this headache? And for every person who is standing up and saying, you know what, there's something greater at play here, the answer is still yes. Those folks are heroes. And the president doing that during, as Teddy Roosevelt referred to it, the bully pulpit, as Donald Trump is clearly aware, even though he's probably unaware of the quote, I'm sure he thinks he invented it, of the presidency, that it is a different field when the president of the United States goes after an individual. It is absolutely witness tampering. Now, whether or not everyone else sees it and everyone else hears Donald Trump saying, well, you know, I have the right to speak. Yes, he does. But there is a proper way for a president to speak on this kind of issue.
All right. But Rich Rubino, we're now getting into territory that we've never seen in the three previous impeachments that have happened in this country, let alone seeing anything that we've ever dealt with in real time in politics. Is the tweet storm of the president effective in diverting attention away from the substance of the testimony of the witnesses? Is the tweet storms that he and now Don Jr. put out, are they being effective in questioning the credibility of these witnesses? Where are we going on this?
Indirectly. I mean, they're certainly putting out talking points for the president's supporters more than anything else. I think, though, the president, when he specifically was when he was tweeting in real time back on Friday, you know, Chairman Schiff was brilliant. He actually read the tweet directly and had the witness respond to what was going on. And I think the American people, at least those who are kind of centrist, who aren't necessarily, you know, political junkies, would follow that and say, you know, why is the president spending his time doing this? Why is he spending his time tweeting? But, you know, I guess it's like Franklin Roosevelt, I guess, mastered the art of essentially coming on using fireside chats. John F. Kennedy used television. I guess that there's a new medium right now, and the new medium is Twitter, and that's the one thing that Donald Trump has mastered, and he uses it as a way to circumvent what he would call, I guess, the lying media or the lamestream media. He would say that this is the only way that I can talk to the American people directly, because there are a lot of his supporters, a lot of very reputable people who believe essentially that everything that they hear, virtually everything they hear on any channel, including, by the way, Fox News sometimes, is essentially made up and it's part of some sort of a grand liberal conspiracy in the deep state. It's the only way they're going to hear directly the truth is from the president, and this is what gins up and galvanizes his base.
Dan Lipner?
The question is, who are those reputable people that honestly believe what the president is saying?
Well, I think people who are, my guess would be it's people who are not necessarily political, there are plenty of people that, for example, well, here's an example. Someone will run for a congressional seat that they have no chance of winning because they're told that they have some sort of a chance, they're going to get a bunch of money, and so they run for this congressional seat. They have no chance of winning it, but they're reputable in another field. Maybe they're a prominent lawyer, prominent something else, but they don't necessarily know a lot about politics. There might be people who are prominent lawyers, prominent doctors, have a peripheral interest in American politics, and then they hear what essentially Donald Trump is saying. So when it comes to politics, which isn't their specialty, they say, oh, well, this must be the case. So they immediately take kind of red side versus blue side. And there are people on the left as well who just, or they hear internet memes, that type of thing. They're reputable in their field. They're making a lot of money. They're raising their family. They're giving a charity, everything else. But when it comes to politics, they listen to everything that Donald Trump says, and they say, you know, Donald Trump is my tribune. That's kind of my estimation of it.
Alan Moore, is the whataboutism defense that we're hearing, because we, you know, when we heard Devin Nunes give his opening testimony, we heard a lot about Biden, we heard a lot about Burisma, we heard a lot about everything, you know, we heard about Hillary Clinton in emails at one point. Is the whataboutism working as far as diverting attention? Is it a diversion?
Well, it in part it's a diversion, but when you're trying to move people's attention from this train wreck over here, you try to divert them to something else, and if they can establish a linkage, at least it may cause people to think a little bit about it. The Republicans do not have a strong hand right now because all the facts that are being laid out are basically establishing that the first reports from from the whistleblower have turned out to be true. And in fact, on the quid pro quo question, it's increasingly evident that, yes, this was going to be a condition. Now, the question is, so the Republicans can't really refute that. And for last week, they could say this is hearsay evidence because most of these people have never met the president. Well, fine. Let's bring that group in that knows what the president said. And we're going to hear from Sondland tomorrow, unless he bails for some reason. But he's got his own personal reputation and personal business, which I think he will be rejoining in the fairly near future to salvage it. A string of boutique hotels that are already being subject to boycott threats.
Right.
And the guy's trying to salvage his own reputation. He's in way over his head. But he's going to be a first person witness, unlike most of these others. Not that I have a problem with hearsay witnesses, don't get me wrong, but the argument goes, well, courts of law use hearsay testimony all the time, but it's not as powerful as eyewitness or ear witness testimony.
Right.
So, you know, the Republicans have a weak hand, and they do have an argument that resonates with a lot of their following and with some independent folks that say, you know, it really is true. From day one, a lot of Democrats have tried to get this guy out of office. And when the Mueller investigation came up short, they pivoted immediately. Well, so when that's all you got, that's what you talk about. Trashing individuals, trashing career servants, civil servants, trashing career military people out of desperation, that looks petty and small. And that's why I think why the Republicans the Republicans on Friday then couldn't come after, and not that it would have been easy to come after her, but they almost all started out thanking her for their extraordinary service and have to be angry as all get out, couldn't be as critical as they might like to have been because of the president's crazy tweet.
Last question, Dan Lipner. We heard Adam Schiff and several members of the intelligence community use the B word. We've heard Pelosi now use the B word, that being bribery. Are they overplaying their hand by bringing in the bribery aspect? And is that going to shun off some independent voters that might be supportive of holding Trump's feet to the fire?
No. The reason for the bribery thing, and while Representative Nunez is saying, you know, there are focus groups that say that, you know, they heard the word bribery because people didn't like the word quid pro quo. Well, to Alan's point, yes, there are always this for that items at play in foreign policy. While that is true, not necessarily this for that.
But it's bribery theater of the policy, is bribery.
Let me finish. So are at play the this for that, which is what quid pro quo means, exchange for personal gain, is a different issue. Bribery, and this is the issue. One, it's actually in the Constitution. Two, and this is where the Federalist Papers folks actually have a point. Nobody had ever foreseen. The Federalist Papers folks are talking about bribery in the context of the president being the recipient of bribery. Never had they thought about the president actually bribing a foreign party to get involved with U.S. elections. This was inconceivable.
All right. But again, I go to the question of is there bribery in what we're seeing, at least in the testimony and the evidence that we've seen so far in the committee?
Yes, that is the essence of what a quid pro quo is.
No, it's not bribery, it's extortion. Come on, what's wrong with you guys?
I mean, but here's the thing is.
Actually, I think extortion more accurately portrays. They want
it's
to
a
use
RICO charge.
They want to use bribery because the word bribe is in the Constitution, even though, as Dan accurately points out, it was intended to avoid presidents being on the take.
Right. But again, are they, in fact,
extortion is a bit more complicated, but bribery is part of extortion. The problem is the extortion implies I'm going to break your knees unless you do this.
But okay, but instead of breaking your knees, so what I'm hearing from you, Dan, and from Alan, is that instead of breaking your knees, we're going to let Russia walk into Kiev, and you guys are going to be looking under a Russian flag in about 5 months. Is that the understanding? Is that the extortion?
Absolutely.
The extortion is we got $400 million worth of aid that you desperately need and want and have expected to receive. And, oh, by the way, you're
Ukrainian
not going to get it.
Ukrainian soldiers are dying in the process unless we get these missiles.
And you're not going to get that unless you can do some stuff for us. That is classic extortion.
But so, again, what we're hearing is that this president could, in fact, be above the law of extortion.
Well, there's a couple of questions here. Could he be prosecuted for extortion?
Well, we already know he can't be prosecuted.
So DOJ said that. So then the question is, let's suppose that there was an effort to extort that didn't succeed, as the Republicans will point out. Is that an impeachable offense? You know, it may be prosecutable, just like the whole obstruction of justice and the Mueller stuff, or does it go away because it didn't happen? The question before the country, before the House first, and then presumably the Senate, is it bad enough to result in the removal from office?
Okay. Go ahead, Rich Rubino. I'm going to give you the last word.
One thing that I think, just in terms of the RICO statute, was brought up. Just a quick fact: James Traficant, back in 1983, is the only the first American to beat a RICO statute representing himself in court.
Wow! Did not. And the fact that you even brought up James Traficant, that's impressive.
This was the first time he beat it in 1983. Then later on, there were other charges, but this was the first time he was.
Thank you for bringing up Traficant. Always enjoyable.
Yes, I have to bring him in. As soon as I heard RICO, that rang in my head. I have a big picture of Jim Traficant saying, "Beat me up with that hair."
And you love that hair. That's right.
From the floor of the House said, "A guy who does his hair with a weed whacker."
Yeah,
his words.
That's true. On behalf of Dan Lipner, Rich Rubino, Alan Moore. Special thanks always to Eric Thomas, our producer, doing Eric Thomas type things today. Rob, the engineer behind the glass, keeping us open. You can follow us on Twitter. Now, I haven't gotten questions. Follow us on Twitter at Backroom Politic. We leave the last S off for savings. You can also find us on our website, backroompolitics.org. Find us on Facebook. You can also download our podcast on every service that you like: Google, Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, even Spreaker. You can find us anywhere. Anyway, that being the case, have a great week, America. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.